23. When I woke next morning, I was lying in the middle of the bright blue ground sheet and the sun was up. The old men wanted more meat for breakfast. The ice in the esky had melted in the night, and the steaks were swimming in blood-coloured water. We decided to cook them before they went off. I relit the embers of the fire while Arkady held a conference with Alan and the man in blue. He showed them on the survey map how the railway would miss the Lizard Rock by at least 2 miles and got them reluctantly to agree to this. Next, he pointed to the 25-mile stretch of country through which he intended to drive. For most of the morning, the vehicles edged slowly northwards over broken ground. The sun was blinding and the vegetation parched and drear. To the east, the land dropped away and lifted towards a ridge of pale sandhills. The valley in between was covered with a continuous thicket of mulga trees, leafless at this season, silver-grey like a blanket of low-lying mist. Nothing moved except the shimmering heat waves. We kept crossing the path of fires. In places, all that survived of the bushes were upright, fire-hardened spikes, which staked our tyres as we ran over them. We had 3 flats, and Marian had 2 in the Land Rover. Whenever we stopped to change a wheel, dust and ash blew in our eyes. The women would jump down delightedly and go off to look for bush tucker. Mavis was in a very boisterous mood and wanted to repay me for the thongs. She grabbed my hand and dragged me towards a limp green bush.
"Hey, where are you two going?" Arkady called.
"Get him some bush bananas," she shouted back. "He don't know bush bananas."
But the bananas, when we got to them, had shriveled up to nothing. Another time, she and Topsy tried to run down a goanna, but the reptile was far too quick for them. At last, she found a plant of ripe solanum berries and showered them on me in handfuls. They looked and tasted like unripe cherry tomatoes. I ate some to please her, and she said,
"There you are, dearie,"
and reached out her chubby hand and stroked my cheek. When anything in the landscape even half resembled a feature, Arkady would break and ask old Alan,
"What's that one?" or "Is this country clear?"
Alan glared from the window at his domain. Around noon we came to a clump of eucalyptus, the only patch of green in sight. Nearby there was an outcrop of sandstone, about 20 feet long and scarcely visible above the surface. It had shown up on the aerial survey, and was one of 3 identical outcrops lying in line along the ridge. Arkady told Alan that the engineer might want to quarry this rock for ballast. He might want to blast it with dynamite.
"How about that, old man?"
he asked. Alan said nothing.
"No story here? Or nothing?"
He said nothing.
"So the country's clear, then?"
"No."
Alan took a deep sigh.
"The babies."
"Whose babies?"
"Babies,"
he said. And in the same weary voice he began to tell the story of the babies. In the dream time, the bandicoot man, Akuka, and his brother were hunting along this ridge. Because it was the dry season, they were terribly hungry and thirsty. Every bird and animal had fled. The trees were stripped of leaves, and bushfires swept across the country. The hunters searched everywhere for an animal to kill, until, almost at his final gasp, Akuka saw a bandicoot bolting for its burrow. His brother warned him not to kill it, for to kill one's own kind was taboo. Akuka ignored the warning. He dug the bandicoot from the burrow, speared it, skinned it, and ate it, and immediately felt cramps in his stomach. His stomach swelled and swelled, and then it burst, and a throng of babies spewed forth and started crying for water. Dying of thirst, the babies travelled north, up to Singleton, and south back to Taylor Creek, where the dam now is. They found the soakage, but drank up all the water and returned to the 3 rocky outcrops. The rocks were the babies, huddled together as they lay down to die, although, as it happened, they did not die yet. Their uncle, Akuka's brother, heard their cries and called on his western neighbours to make rain. The rain blew in from the west. The grey expanse of mulga was the thunderstorm metamorphosed into trees. The babies turned on their tracks and wandered south again. While crossing a creek, not far from Lizard Rock, they fell into the floodwaters and melted. The name of the place where the babies went back was Aquae Capentae, which means far-travelling children. When Alan came to the end of the story, Arkady said softly,
"Don't worry, old man. It'll be all right. Nobody's going to touch the babies."
Alan shook his head despairingly.
"Are you happy, then?" asked Arkady.
No, he wasn't happy. Nothing about this wicked railway was going to make him happy, but at least the babies might be safe. We moved ahead.
"Australia," Arkady said slowly, "is the country of lost children."
Another hour, and we reached the northern border of Middleborough Station. We now had one spare tyre for the Land Cruiser, so rather than risk returning the way we'd come, we decided to make a detour. There was an old dirt road which went east and then south and came out behind Alan's settlement. On the last lap, we ran in with the railway people. They were clearing the country along the proposed line of track. Their earth movers had cut a sweep through the mulga, and a strip of churned-up soil about 100 yards wide now stretched away into the distance. The old men looked miserably at the stacks of broken trees. We stopped to talk to a black-bearded titan. He was more than 7 feet tall, and might have been made of bronze. Stripped to the waist, in a straw hat and stubbies, he was driving in marker posts with a hammer. He was off, in an hour or two, to Adelaide on leave.
"Oh, boy," he said, "am I ever glad to get out of here?"
The road had gone. Our vehicles crawled and slewed in the loose red dirt. 3 times we had to get out and push. Arkady was whacked. I suggested we stop for a break. We turned aside into the sketchy shade of some trees. There were anthills everywhere, splashed with bird shit. He unpacked some food and drink and rigged up the ground sheet as an awning. We had expected the old men, as always, to be hungry, but they all sat huddled together, moping, refusing either to eat or to talk. To judge from their expressions, you would have said they were in pain. Marion and the ladies had parked under a different tree, and they, too, were silent and gloomy. A yellow bulldozer went by in a cloud of dust. Arkady lay down, covered his head with a towel, and started snoring. Using my leather rucksack as a pillow, I leaned back against a tree trunk and leafed through Ovid's Metamorphoses. The story of Lycaon's transformation into a wolf took me back to a blustery spring day in Arcadia, and seeing, in the limestone cap of Mount Lycaon itself, an image of the crouching Beast King. I read of Hyacinth and Adonis, of Deucalion and the Flood, and how the living things were created from the warm Nilotic ooze. And it struck me, from what I now knew of these songlines, that the whole of classical mythology might represent the relics of a gigantic song map, that all the to-ing and fro-ing of gods and goddesses, the caves and sacred springs, the sphinxes and chimeras, and all the men and women who became nightingales or ravens, echoes or narcissi, stones or stars, could all be interpreted in terms of totemic geography. I must have dozed off myself, for when I woke, my face was covered with flies, and Arkady was calling,
"Come on, let's go!"
We got back to Middleborough an hour before sunset. The Land Cruiser had hardly stopped moving before Alan and the man in blue opened their doors and walked away without a nod. Big Tom mumbled something about the railway being bad. Arkady looked crushed.
"Hell," he said, "what's the use?"
He blamed himself for letting them see the earth movers.
"You shouldn't," I said.
"But I do. They were bound to see it one day. I'd rather not with me."
We freshened up under a hose pipe, and I revived our hearth of the day before. Marion joined us, sitting on a sawn-off tree lump and unravelling her tangle of hair. She then compared notes with Arkady. The women had told her of a songline called Two Dancing Women, but it never touched the line of the railway. We looked up to see a procession of women and children on their way back from foraging. The babies swayed peacefully in the folds of their mothers' dresses.
"You never hear them cry," Marion said, "as long as the mother keeps moving."
She had touched unwittingly on one of my favourite topics.
"And if babies can't bear to lie still," I said, "how shall we settle down later?"
She jumped to her feet.
"Which reminds me, I've got to go."
"Now?"
Now, I promised Gladys and Topsy they'd be home tonight.
Can't they stay here? I asked. Couldn't we all spend the night here?
You can, she said, playfully sticking out her tongue. I can't.
I looked at Arkady, who shrugged as if to say, when she gets an idea into her head, no power on earth's going to stop her. 5 minutes later, she had rounded up the women, and with a cheerful wave, was gone.
That woman, I said, is the Pied Piper.
Damn it, said Arkady. He reminded me of our promise to look in on Frank Olsen. At the station house, a large woman with heat-ravaged skin came shuffling to the front door, peered through the fly-screen, and opened up.
Frank's gone down to Glen Armand, she said. An emergency. Jim Hanlon's taken sick.
When was that? Asked Arkady.
Last night, said the woman. Collapsed in the pub.
We should get the chaps and go, he said.
Yes, I agreed. I think we'd better go.